Matthew 25 is where we've left off, specifically Matthew 25, verses 28 through 30. Just to kind of give you a preview of where we're headed tonight, we want to do a textual study of Matthew 25. Lord willing, we'll do another textual study of Matthew 25 next week, and that will finish out this chapter. Once we get through Matthew 25, we've kind of got a break for a couple of reasons. Then we're ready for things about the Lord's Supper, and it's also the fall where we typically go back to a class book. So we will fall and winter, and up until the first part of spring, Lord willing, go through that class book and then come back to Matthew and look at what we have in 26, the Lord's Supper, and continue on. And we've gone through in Matthew 25 the parable of the 10 virgins. We've also looked at the information about the talents. And it's not so much as far as dealing with natural ability here, but it's the things that God has given us, being faithful as far as the teaching of the talents. You remember how many guys in the story of the talents got talents?
Three.
First guy received? Okay. Receives five, turns them into 10. Second guy receives two, turns them into?
Four.
Turns them into four. And then we have the third guy, he gets one, turns it into
nothing.
He just buries it. All right, we got down through almost verse 28, but let's read verses 26 and 27 to get a little of the context. But his Lord, and this is the third guy, the faithless servant, but his Lord answered and said unto him, thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I did not scatter. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the bankers, and at my coming I should have received back mine own with interest. Now new material, 28 through 30. Take ye away therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him that hath the 10 talents. For every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not, even that which he hath shall be taken away. And cast ye out the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness, where there shall be the weeping and the gnashing of teeth. What's that old saying? Use it or lose it. Well, isn't that what we find here? We have been given various abilities, various resources to work with, and God says, you, as you live your life out on earth, you need to make sure that you use these things in the right way. Now, there's something that puzzles me about this passage, and as of yet, I've never figured it out. Maybe tonight somebody will have a good answer or something that will maybe jog our thinking a bit. The fella, he loses his talent. And where does it go? Yeah. Why do you think that is? Could he have given it to the fellow who had five? Sure. Could he have said, I'm not going to give it to anybody else? That also would have been a choice. Why give the talent that the fellow didn't use well to the fellow who had 10? Anybody want to take a stab at that? I don't know that I know the answer. Well, okay, we got three or four answers. I saw Harvey first, then I heard Sherman first, and then Molly, I heard you. So
done.
Now let's see if that's true. The guy that had five, how many did he make?
Five.
The guy who had two, how many did he make? Two. So if you look at it on that level, you have to say he really didn't make any more. He started out, you know, if you start out with 10, you start out with 20, and you get 20 and you get 40, you know, you started out with more, but you still only doubled at the end of the day. Yes. I mean, it sounds more. So, okay, we're going to come back to you if you'd like to follow up. Sherman?
That's kind of like what Harvey said, but, you know, even today, the richer gets richer, the poorer gets poorer. That's kind of like what happened here. The richer did get richer as far as talent goes, and the one who had none ended up with nothing.
Yeah. Easy in the secular realm to make that point, but in the spiritual realm, this is where I struggle with this. And that very well could be. I think that's a logical, that's a very common sense answer. So that's definitely worthy of consideration. Anybody else?
Was it because he was the first one who gave the talents to?
Maybe. That's not a bad answer either. Anybody else?
Spiritually thinking about it, here's a man that doubled what he had, and so did the two talent men, but the fellow that made the five talents, spiritually thinking now, maybe if we was to look at ourselves that way, how many people are we bringing to the Lord? The Lord would want to give us some more, that we something more to work with that would bring, still bring more.
Yeah, and that's another worthy thought. Anybody else? Stan?
I have a question, not necessarily so much an answer, but why did he give five to the one man first? Why did he only give two to the other one first?
The impression that I'm left with, and again, I could be wrong on this, but it seems to be based on ability.
Then wouldn't you want to give the one with the most ability the most
ability? I'm kind of thinking that. I mean, that still doesn't satisfy me completely. Maybe I'm just hard to satisfy on this point. But it could be that the two-talent guy, I mean, that was really kind of maxing him out with the 10-talent guy, as we've kind of heard from the other answers. He had some additional ability that was not, you know, fully used. But I do think that that's interesting, and maybe it's a point that you just can't draw out too much. But it's always been something that's kind of puzzled me. Why did he get it? You know, could he have split it up? I mean, a talent's a lot of money. So couldn't he have given the 5-talent guy 80% of it? The 2-talent guy 20%? Now, once again, maybe that's reading too much into it, but to me it just seems very, very interesting. Dolores?
This may not, I don't know, I'm just thinking out loud, but even if you put it in a work mode, I work just as hard at the front desk as, maybe not as Sherman, but as a lot of people at work. And yet, when it comes time for a reward in the form of pay or congratulations or whatever, even though I work that hard, just like the man who doubled the 2 talents, I'm not going to get as much as the one who already had that. And maybe they had to work even harder because of the fact that there wasn't just 2 talents to worry about. There was, you know, he was coming up with 10 talents. And it's probably harder to manage $1 million in all the right places than it is $10.
And I've thought about that too, and that is likely part of the answer as well. That not that he really, you know, in one sense deserved more, but in the other sense, there is some truth in that. Because if you're, you know, doubling 2 talents, that's one thing, but if you're doubling 5, you are going to have probably hustle a little bit more because you have that much more to work with, especially when you go back and think about that. So again, that's always been kind of a point of interest to me, and one that has always puzzled me a little bit, why this guy got the whole talent back when there was another individual who was also faithful. So something else pops to mind as we continue through this account. Let me know. I'm sorry, Betty.
Another thing, the guy knows the heart of the person.
Mm-hmm.
So he maybe needed that the person that he had given the most to would be the one that would come near using it.
Yeah.
To increase it, where the other 2-talent guy may not have had quite that ability to go ahead and use that other talent.
Yeah.
So, you know, he knows our hearts, so it's...
Right. Yeah, and I think that's right. The guy who managed 2, maybe that was his maximum capacity, and he did as well as the other guy, but the other fellows still had a little more room to go ahead and you know, kind of like Walmart. You know, they've always got room to add on something else. They're so big. And mom and pop shop, they do pretty well with what they do, but it's kind of like if we go out and expand anymore, it's going to overburden us. So, the other key point, Stan?
You made the comment that maybe that's stretching this a little too far, and I think we oftentimes do that with parables. I think it's an important point, and I think it's an important point because when you stop and think about it, why did he give that talent to the 5-talent man? The master's returning. He's requiring what he had given them to start with. In other words, the money should all went back to him. But this says specifically that he took that talent and gave it to that other person. There must be a reason.
Yeah, and like I say, I've puzzled over it for a long, long time. And so far, I've kind of come up with some of the things, same things that have been mentioned, but as far as an answer where I just say, I really like this, and I think this makes me feel pretty complete about the thought, so far, I'm not quite there.
The Gospel Advocate Commentary kind of agrees with what's been said, that it is given to the men according to their abilities. Mm-hmm. So he probably saw this one that had 5 talents and greater abilities, you know, to do more of God's word and the truth.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing in the text that says that, you know, the two man or the five man or the one man, they were limited to this. That, I mean, it was the maximum that they could take. You would think that there was some elasticity there, some ability to go beyond that, and maybe the five-talent man was able to go stretch to the point where he was able to actually encompass another talent, whereas the two-talent guy was not. Okay, I think as we go through this, we want to pick up one of the main lessons, and that is, if the person is not faithful, then what happens? God says, here are the things I've given you. If you're not going to be faithful, they're going to be taken away. They're going to be stripped. Did Saul have that issue? Wasn't faithful as far as his service to God and what happened to him in the kingdom, 1 Samuel 15. No longer king. And this is not the only time. If you go back and you look at the life of Christ, we see Matthew 13, verse 12, a little later, Matthew 21, 43, but back from where we are, Luke 19, verse 26, and so forth. Jesus makes this point repeatedly that if you're not willing to be faithful, if you're not willing to use the things that have been entrusted to you, then don't expect to fare very well. Saved people will be richly rewarded, as we see in this teaching. The unsaved people will not. One commentator made this point, which I think is good. He says, whereas the parable of the 10 virgins emphasizes the importance of keeping one's spiritual life up to date, fresh and full, the parable of the talent shows a necessity for being faithful and vigorous in the service of the kingdom. In other words, Jesus, and we've talked about this a little bit before, there are two related, but two distinct teachings as far as the parable of the virgins plus what we have here, the parable of the talents. And we need to make sure that we do both. I want to show you something else. We need some cross-references read tonight. Let's stick here and let's get somebody over. In fact, the whole class may want to shoot over to Luke 17, verse 10. Alisa, did you have a thought? Okay. All right. Let's head over to Luke 17, verse 10. I want to show you something which I think is a fascinating point from the original text. Kind of keep your hand in Luke 17, 10, and let's bear in mind what we just picked up from Matthew 25, 30. In 25, 30, he says, and cast ye out what kind of servant? Cast you out the unprofitable servant. Now, if we're in Luke 17, 10, let's have that passage read. Who wants to take care of it? Betty?
Even so, also, when you shall have done all the things that are commanded you, say, we are unprofitable servants. We have done that which it was our duty to do.
Okay. The word unprofitable is the same word in both places. And these are the only two times in the New Testament where we find this word translated unprofitable. Now let's put these two passages together. What do we just find in Luke 17:10? When ye shall have done how much? Okay. Or all that is commanded you. Can you imagine somebody that would actually do all that's commanded? Yeah, Jesus pictures this kind of situation. He says, if you've done everything that's commanded you, what kind of servant are you? You're unprofitable. Now Matthew 25, verse 30, here's the guy who buries his talent. What kind of servant is he? Unprofitable. Well, what's the difference between the two? We're both unprofitable. Okay. Okay. But still, he says, when you've done all that is required of you, so we've got to tie in attitude a little bit. But what else? You think grace comes into play there? You've done all that's commanded you, but you're still unprofitable. But the people in Luke 17:10, are they going to be saved?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they sought to be obedient to God. In Matthew 25, you're right, Matthew 25:30, this guy did not. So I think that's interesting. Everybody that stands before God on the day of judgment, all who are accountable, everybody who is there is going to be unprofitable. Doesn't matter what kind of elder we were. Doesn't matter what kind of preacher we were. Doesn't matter what kind of husband, wife we were, Bible class teacher. Every single one is going to be unprofitable. But there will be some people there who sought to be obedient to God, who loved Him and served Him. And to those unprofitable servants, what will God say? Later in the chapter in Matthew 25, come ye blessed of my Father. And He's going to recognize the works. You did go out and see some people in prison, and you took care of the hungry and so forth, and gave some people a cup of cold water. You did some small things. Unprofitable. But still, my grace, my love, is going to be the basis for your entering into heaven. So, very, very interesting word, and a very powerful word when we realize where it's used. Anything else before we pick up with verses 31 to 33 in Matthew 25?
Could this not also you've done everything that was commanded you because it was your duty to do it. You didn't, but you didn't do it with a glad heart or a willing heart. Or, would that have a connotation there?
And that's why I said with Marcia's statement, you do want to make sure that you include the right attitude. We don't serve God because he's some kind of slave master and so forth. But there does need to be the right attitude as far as love. And if you go back a little bit in Luke 17, I was going to just kind of go back here and see what we had in verse 5 and following. And the apostles said unto the Lord, increase our faith. And the Lord said, if you had faith as of grain of mustard seed, you would say unto the sycamore tree, be rooted up, planted in the sea, and it would obey you. But who is there of you, having a servant plowing or keeping sheep, that will say to him, when he has come in from the field, come straight away, come immediately, and sit down to meat? And will not rather say unto him, make ready wherewith that I may sup and gird myself and serve me till I've eaten and drunken, and afterward thou shalt eat and drink. Doth he thank the servant because he did the things that were commanded? Well, obviously not. The servant knows his role, the servant recognizes his responsibility and does it. So you do have that element of attitude introduced in the preceding verses, and that needs to be something that we recognize as well. You know, God has said, here are my rules. We seek to be those. We seek to be obedient to those and have the right attitude. But some people don't always do that. It's kind of like, well, you know, he's got the stick and the whip and we better obey or else. But that's not how we intended to set up the system. Okay, let's go back to Matthew 25 and see what we find in verses 31 to 33. But when the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the angels with him, then shall he sit on the throne of his glory. And before him shall be gathered all the nations. And he shall separate them one from another as the shepherd separateth the sheep from the goats. And he shall set the sheep on his right hand, but the goats on his left. Now, if you think back a little bit in the chapter, Jesus has already illustrated it by the teaching of the ten virgins. Remember? Some are going to be prepared. Some are not going to be prepared. And now as we finish up verses 14 through 30, he's talked about the need to be faithful during the time that he's away, by the teaching, by the parable of the talents. Now, Jesus is going to give a brief overview of what's going to happen when he returns. I'm going to lay out some cross-references in conjunction with this to try to give you, as far as I can tell, the things that are going to take place when the Lord returns at the end of time. I spent a little time on this some time ago for some information in the book of Revelation. And now tonight, kind of try to tie all these things together. So I would like to get some cross-references read. So if you'll be thinking about, as the verses are offered, I'll take that one. That would help move things along. We do know, remember Matthew 24, verse 36, the Lord's coming is going to be at a time when, who knows, it's going to be. But of that day and hour, knoweth no man. So as the Lord talks about his next and final coming here, we do know for sure that it's going to take place at a time that we cannot predict. And then, before we introduce these cross-references, let's see what else the Lord says. Is there anything in verse 31 that really stands out?
The angel will be with
them. Yeah, but not only will angels be with them, all. Now, to me, that's a small detail, but that's a mighty important detail. Do you remember from Hebrews 12, I believe it's verse 22, the number of angels? Hebrew writer says they are... You're on the verge of it. Innumerable, right? Well, you think they can literally be numbered? You don't think they can be counted? Yeah, I mean, there is a number. But he says they're innumerable to make what point?
A lot.
There's a bunch of them. And the idea that there will not be a single angel left in heaven when the Lord returns. To me, that's an amazing thought. I don't know how many people will have lived when the Lord comes back. I mean, just if you count the number of abortions, we're dealing with a significant number of people. And if you've got about 6,000 years of human history, I mean, you know, a lot of people have walked the globe since the foundation of the world. So tons of people, maybe millions, maybe billions of angels, trillions of angels. I don't know how big it is. But the Lord, through the Hebrew writer, reminds us that it's going to be a significant number of people. Let's get our readers lined up. John 5, 28 and 29. You have a couple minutes to get there. Brian, Jeff, after that, we'll assign 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 17 to you. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 17. Sherman, we'll take your hand. Matthew 13, 41 and 49. Matthew 13, 41 and 49. And then Revelation 14, Josh, that will be you. Revelation 14, verses 17 through 20. And after that, we'll pick up some other things. Let's start with John 5, 28 and 29. Okay, so here you have the Lord coming back, Matthew 25. There is that shout that Paul talks about in the Thessalonian letter, and what happens to all the dead? Up they come. What about the dead that died out on the sea somewhere? Under the sea, in the submarine. What about the people from the Space Shuttle Challenger 20-some years ago? What's going to happen? Whether they died outside our atmosphere, whether they died, you know, down in a coal mine, whether they died in a sea, whether they're sealed up in some cave, the bones are still there. What's the promise in John 5, 28 and 29? They're all going to be raised. Well, okay, that's one thing for the dead. And that's a pretty incredible promise. But you think there's still going to be some people living on the earth when the Lord comes back? Sure. So let's see what he says about that. Paul, 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 17.
Then we who are alive, who are left, will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air. And so we will always be with the Lord.
Okay, so at this stage, Jesus comes back. We've got all the dead being raised up. The righteous that are still living on the earth, they're also raised up to meet the Lord in the clouds. But we haven't, with these passages, come to any information yet as far as what's going to happen with the unsaved. Now, you know, granted, we've got them, John 5, 28 and 29, being raised up as well. So let's flip over to our next passage, Matthew 13, verses 41 and 49.
41?
Matthew 13, 41, and then also verse 49, same chapter.
41. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out his kingdom and all things that offend, and those who practice lawlessness. 49. So will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth, separate the wicked from among the just.
Okay. Now this takes us to kind of an additional step that we need to think about for just a second. Again, let's go through the details. The Lord comes back. Dead are all raised up. The righteous meet the Lord in the air. Well, we ask the question, what about the unsaved? Now Matthew 13 gives us an answer. What's going to happen to them? Who are they going to be met by? Just the angels. It's almost as if this is an insult to the unsaved. You know, the Lord, you know, not interested in collecting them, at least for the purpose of meeting them. They are going to have a meeting with them as far as being sent away. But very, very interesting. And then Joshua, Revelation 14 reader, right? John makes this same point in Revelation 14, verses 17 through 20.
Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven, and each ear had a sharp sickle. Then another angel came out from the altar, the angel who has authority over the fire. And he called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle, put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, for its grapes are ripe. So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered the great harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the winepress, as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia.
Okay, being tossed into the winepress of God, does that sound positive or not? Not, probably not. I mean, you're being squeezed to death, and out comes the juice, and the word blood is used. So obviously that's not a very pleasant thing. Who's doing this? God or angels? Angels. Well, that's the same, you know, same information that we have in Matthew 13, only it's a lot more graphic in Revelation chapter 14. So it's one more reminder, and let me make this quick point as well. When you think about men over the ages in the Bible who have seen an angel, even for the most righteous, a good experience or a bad? It was terrifying. So just to meet up, you know, with the angels, and when you got the bunch of them, the innumerable host, Hebrews 12, verse 22, it is going to be a very, very terrifying time for these people. Then as we look at Matthew 25, as we kind of drill down here, then we've got everybody's, you know, gathered together, the Lord's come, and, you know, everybody's kind of been collected and so forth. Then 25, 31 to 33, he's going to come, he's going to sit on his throne, there's going to be the great glory, and then all the nations, verse 32, will be gathered together, and then there's going to be a separation, which we'll talk about just a little bit more. And after the separation is complete, And part of that's going to be based on what people did. Matthew 25, verses 34 through 35. People are going to be pronounced as righteous or unrighteous. Sherman, you still by chance back in Matthew 13? I didn't suspect that you were, but if you could go back there for just a second.
I'm there.
Okay, Matthew 13, verses 49 through 50.
So it will be at the end of the age, the angels will come forth, separate the wicked from among the just, and cast them into the furnace of fire. There will be wailing and gnashing of teeth.
Okay, now once again, to me this is an interesting statement. We might expect that Jesus is going to be the one that's going to fling these people, the unsaved, off into eternity. But once again, you kind of get the impression that the Lord wants to so distance himself from the unrighteous. Who's going to deal with the unsaved? Who's going to be involved with the mop-up operation? Angels. They're going to cast the unsaved into hell. So angels are definitely going to have a great part at this particular day. So the Bible warns us, 2 Corinthians 6:2, a lot of other passages that we need to be prepared. Scripture also tells us, though, that most people are not going to be prepared. We've got the information earlier in Matthew 24 about, remember, Noah, the ark. And people were eating, they were drinking, they were being involved in marriage and so forth. They didn't expect it. Well, that's going to be the same way that things are at the end of time. Remember 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 3? Paul said, the day of the Lord is going to come as a thief in the night. People are not going to be ready. And such was also true when it was time for the flood in ancient times. Let's make a couple of the quick points here and then talk about some things related to the saved and the lost. Let's head somebody over to the book of Revelation chapter 6, verses 15 through 17, and then also 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 and 12. Revelation 6, 15 and 17, all right, Elisa, and then 2 Peter chapter 3, we'll look at verses 10 and 12. Dolores, I think I saw your hand. 2 Peter 3, verses 10 through 12. Revelation 6, let's go there first. Verses 15 to 17, Elisa.
And the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man, hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand?
Okay. My understanding of these verses is that they describe basically Jesus is ready to come down, and down he comes, and the initial reaction of people at the time of the Lord's next and final coming. Now, we see in life situations where people are exposed to an event that is terror-related. Building begins to collapse, there's a mudslide, there's an earthquake or something like that. And what's the reaction? Anybody remember from 9/11 the pictures of what was taking place? What were people doing?
Running.
They were running. And people weren't, you know, well, let's go ahead and take a couple pictures and let's get a video of what's behind me. It's drop what we have, run down the street as fast as we can, get out of the building as quickly as we can. We are fleeing for our lives. That's a picture in Revelation 6, only people are going to be going as quickly as they can. But in this situation, Revelation 6, what's the difference going
to
be?
Where
are you going to go? You know, there is no rock, there is no cave, there is no building where you can go and hide, there is no deep elevator where you can go underground and hang out for a little while, because everybody is going to be raised up to meet the Lord. And then you have this little detail, 2 Peter 3, 10 and 12. Dolores.
10 and 12 or 10 through 12?
10 and 12, you can skip verse 11, that would be great. Sun, moon, stars, earth, they're all going to disappear. So where are you going to go? There will be no place. And the question in Revelation 6 is basically rhetorical. How can we hide from the wrath of the Lamb? The answer is you can't. There's not going to be any kind of spot left. So everybody will be brought before the Lord. And then moving back to Matthew 25, what's the image? The Lord says people are going to be separated. They're going to be divided. What's the analogy that he uses? It's like a shepherd who does what? He separates the goats from the sheep. Which group is on which hand? All right, sheep will be on his right hand, the goats will be on his left. Shepherds know their flock, and such is also true for the Lord. The word that's translated separated is always connected with separating in the New Testament. We'll not run the passages for this, but I do want to mention the word goat. The word goat is translated only used two times in the New Testament. It's used here, and depending on your Bible translation, the other passage is at least familiar to you, but maybe you can call it. Anybody else remember, or anybody remember where we read about a goat elsewhere in the New Testament? Yeah. Prodigal son of Luke chapter 15. He says to the dad, you know, here, the younger son, he's gotten the best, he continues to get the best, but you never gave me a goat, or you never, some translations will use the word kid. You never gave me a kid. Well, what does that suggest about the value of a goat? Yeah, you know, here is the cheapest piece of meat, if you will, or if it's not the cheapest, it's right down there. You know, it's about D-grade stuff. And you didn't even give me a goat. So when you look at another passage, Hebrews 11, verse 37, it talks about people wearing goat skin, describes poverty. So even the skin of the goat was not regarded as something that was very valuable. So here, when Jesus says the goats are on the left, they really are the people that he's not going to be very fond of because of sin. Anything you want to add or ask before I raise a question? Okay. Here's my question. Sherman, let's ask you one more time to go back to Matthew 13. I promise that that's the last time. And then we'll have somebody read from Matthew 25, verse 32. If you've never noticed this, you might be a little curious about it. Matthew 13, 41 to 49.
Verse 41?
And 49 from Matthew 13.
The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all things that offend those who practice lawlessness. 49?
Mm-hmm.
So it will be at the end of the age, the angels will come forth, separate the wicked from among the just.
Okay. The separation between the righteous and the unrighteous, we know, we believe that it's going to occur. Matthew 13 tells us that who or what's going to do the separating?
Angels.
Angels. Well, that seems clear enough, doesn't it? Who wants to read Matthew 25, verse 32? Betty?
And before him shall be gathered all the nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as the shepherd separated the sheep from the goats.
Anybody see the problem? Well, you're a step ahead of me. But the point that I want to make is, we said who's doing the separating in Matthew 13? The angels. Who's doing the separating in Matthew 25?
Shepherd son.
All right, shepherd, son, Christ. Now, let's try to put these together. Betty offered some helpful thoughts. Sherman?
Well, in the verses I read, it's clear that Jesus is the one sent out the angels, so they're doing their work before.
Yeah, and I think that's how you, ultimately that's going to be, I mean, what you gave is good, and ultimately I think that would be the answer that I rely on. You remember from the book of Acts, it's over in Acts chapter 1, verse 18. That's what I thought it was. Who bought the field? Well, let's flip over there and see. Who bought a field?
The field?
Yeah. Let's just... Well, let's just go over to the text. Acts 1, verse 18. It says, now this man obtained a field with the reward of his iniquity. And falling headlong, he burst asunder in the midst, and all his bowels gushed out. Who are we talking about?
Judas.
All right, so who bought the field? Acts 1:18.
Jesus.
Okay, that's what it says. But is that really what happened? No. We've got the religious rulers buying the field, don't we? I mean, how's Judas going to buy the field after he's dead? All right, you sometimes have something happening by the agency of another. A person says, well, I bought this, not literally, but there may have been a company that bought it on their behalf. They were working through another individual. And I think, and this is what Sherman was alluding to here, I think this is probably what we have here. It's the same point about, you know, Jesus baptizing people. You have statements which tell us that Jesus didn't baptize, but he was baptizing in the sense that he baptized through his disciples. So very, very common thing. And people sometimes will see these statements and they'll say, well, I don't believe the Bible because it says this here, it says this here, and the two do not agree. There's perfect harmony, but we do need to recognize this principle that we use in the world, it's also used in the Scriptures. Anything that you want to add or ask before we pick up some additional material? Okay. Let's talk for a couple of minutes about some false ideas. Just like anything else, when we think about the end of time, the final sentencing of mankind, we have some ideas that are true, some ideas that are false. There are some people, as you look at verse 32, who would have the idea, and maybe you've not met anybody who espouses this, but they have the idea. It says, and before him shall be gathered all the nations. Can you see how somebody might interpret that? Maybe not interpret it correctly, but how they might say, well, this is what it means. We're going to have America here, and we're going to have Russia here, and we're going to have China here. Australia's back there. You think that's what he meant? Because it says nations. All right. It's a metonymy. You say one thing, but you mean another. So it's not nations individual. How would that work? Could you judge America on the Day of Judgment?
No.
Why is it impossible? Because America consisted of righteous people plus unrighteous. There were the saved and the lost in America, just as there has been in most other countries. So it's impossible to take a nation from any point in human history and actually judge it. If you're going to judge a nation, if you're God and you're going to judge a nation, when do you judge a nation? Well, okay. And when are you going to judge the people in the nation? In eternity or now? Now. That's when you judge people. And isn't that what we saw from Matthew 24 earlier? Remember, Jesus said at the end of Matthew 23 and Matthew 24, let's go back there and look. Starting with 37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, that killeth the prophets and stoneth them that are sent unto her, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house, your city, this nation is left desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth till ye say, blessed is he that comes in the name of the Lord. Not the second time, not the end of time coming, but the destruction of Jerusalem, as he continues on with in Matthew chapter 24. As you think about ancient Rome, they persecuted God's people. What happened to them? God brought them down, didn't he? You go back to ancient Egypt. They were persecuting God's people, even to the point of chasing them into the Red Sea. What happened to them? Well, they got socked pretty hard. Babylon, Assyria, you can just, you know, you think about the various ites in the land. They became so wicked that what God did? Told his people, you go in and you clear them out. Well, they didn't always quite do what his will was. But nations are judged in time. People, though, are judged how and when? In eternity. And that's what we see here. Because remember, Jesus, as he continues on in Matthew 24, he says, you know, you went to see people in prison? Nations don't do that. You clothe the sick? Well, nations might have some responsibility there. But he's actually talking about individuals. So sometimes people will understand the word nation literally, but that is not correct. Anything you want to add or ask on that point? All right, here's something else that you may hear. This is a little more common. Let's suppose that you have a sheep and a goat. Have one of each. Can you make the sheep a goat? Can you make the goat a sheep?
No.
Their nature is changeless. You're not going to be able to transfer one as far as its nature to the other. Can you think how people might use that to promote something that's not true?
Predestination.
Yeah. Oh, isn't that a nice text form? If you're a sheep, you can't become a goat. You can't lose your salvation. And if you're one of those old goats, guess what? You can't become a sheep. So this was something that some of the old-time folks used. You may never come across it in your life, but if you do come across it, then maybe tonight's Bible class will expose you to that. Well, a lot of passages that would help in that. One, of course, is going to be found at the end of the book of Revelation. Revelation 22, if you have the King James translation, I really like how it translates Revelation 22, 17. The ASV, some other translations are also pretty helpful. But in that final chapter, it says, and the Spirit and the Bride say, come. And he that heareth, let him say, come. And he that is athirst, let him say, come. He that willeth, let him take of the water freely. So when he says, he that will, you have several statements here that suggest that it's possible for a person that becomes a sheep to become a goat. And you also have passages in the Bible which indicates that people who do become God's servants, they can also turn back and become one of God's people again because of Christ's shed blood, Revelation chapter 1, verse 5. Anything you might add or ask on that point? Okay, let's toss something else out for consideration. The Lord says the saved are going to be where? They're going to be positioned on His right hand. And the unsaved are going to be positioned on His left hand. As you read through this, would you be inclined to think that this is literally true, or maybe we need to think it's probably not literal? I mean, we've read these verses so many times, we might not even pause to consider that question anymore, but it's something to consider. Will people be literally on the Lord's right hand, literally on the left? Yeah, I wonder about that a little bit, because remember back there in John 4:24, God is Spirit. Now, maybe on the Day of Judgment, there's going to be some kind of form. I don't know. But I guess I would be very, very cautious about saying that this is going to be literally true, that we're going to have, you know, a literal throne and Jesus is actually going to be there. I don't have any question that, you know, people are going to be in the presence of God. It's going to be a very exalted event, but I would use some caution as far as being overly literal with what we're reading about here. Because you have, when it comes to God, a different realm, a spiritual realm, instead of a physical realm. But for us, to make sense out of it, it makes sense. We think about a judge, and he's positioned way up there in the chair, and you've got the courtroom, and you've got a very somber setting, a very serious setting, and all those things will certainly be true on the Day of Judgment. So from human terms, it helps us understand it a little bit, but it may be a little less literal, or a lot less literal than what we initially think. But why the right hand and the left hand?
Separation.
Okay. I think we have to make that point. There is definitely going to be a distinction between those who are unsaved and those who are among the righteous. Anything else? Remember?
That sort of reminds me of when Jacob went to bless Joseph's kids.
Exactly.
It's really important to Joseph that the right hand ended up on Manasseh's head.
Genesis 48, verses 9 through 20. You have there very early in the Bible the idea of the right hand being the hand of blessing, the hand or the side that's going to be the sign of honor, prestige, and so forth. So you have that statement, first book of the Bible, which just seems to continue on throughout Scripture. Now, you do have some cases where the left hand is not necessarily bad, or the left side. Remember, mom comes to Jesus and says, "What do I want for my boys? Make one." All right, one on the right, one on the left. Now, in that setting, would you think that the left hand was a bad spot? I mean, these both were premier places in the kingdom, in the eyes. So there are some cases in the Bible where right and left both, you know, describe honor. But there are some other cases, here being one, where you have the left hand being associated with the place where you don't want to go. But yeah, I think Brian's right as far as going back to Genesis chapter 48, verses 9 to 20. Anything else that you want to touch, Beth? So there again, that would be another great illustration to support what we have back there in Genesis 48. The side of power, honor, glorification, the ideal place to be. But not always true, but there are plenty of times we do find that, and that would be a great illustration of it. Anybody else? Okay, we're going to shut it down there for tonight.